I may be crazy, but I'm here again this morning. Welcome to the Morning Edge on 1490 AM. I am Floyd J. Winters, and with me is Augie.
Your host, Augie, is here as well. And, you know, it's a funny day, but it may be a really a fun day for Manatee County when you have your own port connection to Cuba. That's going to be discussed shortly with Johannes Werner, who's we're holding on the phone here shortly. And Johannes is going to come on and tell you all about what's happening in Central America and all over the Caribbean, plus the ambassador from Cuba who came to Sarasota recently and to Manatee and is talking to us. But I won't get into too much of that. He's going to come forward. Johannes, good morning. From SLR, you do your show twice a month on Tuesdays, 96.5. What is the name of the show so people can tune you in?
It's called Florida Caribe. It's on 96.5 FM in Sarasota, Florida. And thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for coming. Lots of noise about Cuba, lots of possibilities. How much of it's real? How much of it's fiction? What's going on?
Well, as someone covering Cuba, we're publishing the only independent information service covering exclusively the Cuban economy and business in Cuba. And I see as our main function right now to manage overblown expectations. It is clear that things are moving, there is momentum, but it's going to take time. We have the normalization process going on. On May 21st, there will be a third round of negotiations between the United States and Cuba, and this will most likely end with a resumption of full diplomatic relations and the opening of embassies. But it's a difficult process. For instance, there is no ambassador in Washington yet. the Cuban diplomat who is touring Florida this week is technically still the chief of the Cuban interest section in Washington. So there is no one actual post of ambassador in Washington at this point.
So calling him an ambassador is a mistake, or what's the story there?
No, well, it's his rank. Within the Cuban diplomatic service, his rank is ambassador, but his post in Washington is that of chief of the Cuban interest section. That's the official title right now.
His name is Jose Ramon Cabanos Rodriguez.
Yes, Jose Ramon Cabanos Rodriguez. He has a long track record with the United States. He's an interesting person. Within the Cuban Foreign Service, he has been in charge for many years of outreach to Cuban immigrants, Cubans living abroad, and that's, of course, including hundreds of thousands of Cubans living in the United States. So he has very good connections to many of the Cuban American community here in this country, and his English is perfect. He comes across as a personable and a pragmatic kind of diplomat, and he can talk well to business people. He can wear his guayabera and appear very Cuban. The next moment he wears a dark suit and a tie and talks to business people, and he's confident and personable all along.
Now he's already
a very interesting person in a key position right now.
He's given a talk in Sarasota, and he was on a tour of the of Port Manatee, U.S. deepwater port closest to Mariel, and Mariel is Cuba's new container hub. So is that going to, if that connection is made, will that also include travel by tourism and so forth?
You're touching on several issues at a time here, and they all need to get resolved.
Okay.
The immediate issue of his touring Port Manatee on Tuesday morning was ferries. There's something I would call the ferry frenzy going on right now. Last week, or rather 2 weeks ago, the Obama administration began to issue licenses to ferry operators in Florida. This was at least 6 licenses they issued, and there are half a dozen and growing number of companies now vying for position to offer service to Cuba. But as happens very often in this big country, we don't realize there's another side to the story. It takes two to tango. So the message Cabañas sent this week is slow, slow. This will take time. The ferries will have to be set up. This will have to be very well thought. We have not received official applications from either of the ferry operators, so we have to see how this develops. My perspective, my analysis is the Cubans right now don't have a lot of capacity to host a ferry in Havana. There is space, but that space needs to be built up. So most likely the Cubans will begin by picking just one or two of the most professional ferry operators. These are operators that have big partners. There's one consortium that's partnering with a Greek ferry company, another one is a Spanish ferry company, another one is partnering with a French consortium. These are the players most likely to get the first bids to open ferry service to Havana. Now, Port Manatee is
the ferry
very well
service
positioned.
From to Havana from where to where?
Mariano. That's the point. There are several Florida ports. Obviously, from the number of people interested in going, South Florida is the most interesting part for any ferry operator. That would be Miami and Port Everglades. Then there's Key West. That's a natural too. I mean, you can drive all the way to Key West and then hop on a ferry, and in a matter of hours, you're in Havana. And then on this side, Port Manatee, I would argue, is the best situated port.
Why a Greek or French company instead of a Cuban or American company to start the ferry services?
Well, these are all technically U.S. companies. They're based in the United States, but they're partnering with strong foreign partners. You know, there's very little ferry experience in the United States, so they need to look for partners abroad.
You do have a ferry system down in Port Myers that goes down to Key West, so that's already
which,
in
which was started by an Argentinian company, by the way.
Okay, all right.
So there's little experience here in this country with operating ferries, and that's why foreign partners are sought after right now. And Port Manatee is in a good position because we do have a sizable Cuban-American population in the Tampa Bay region, the larger Tampa Bay region. These are probably somewhere around 50,000 people. The port of Tampa would, of course, be closest to where most of the Cuban-Americans in this area live, but the port of Tampa is tucked inside Tampa Bay, and that's probably a loss of between 2 to 3 hours each way compared to Port Manatee, which is situated at the mouth of Tampa Bay.
Oh, that's really interesting. I didn't think about that.
Tampa, Port Manatee is really geographically well suited to do this, and they do have the facilities. They have a berth, they have an old cruise terminal. It's just a matter of weeks, according to the port director, that they could set up
the
infrastructure there. Fort Myers is only suited for small, fast ferry operations, the catamarans that cannot take cars. They don't have a deep water port, so this is shallow going vessels.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's all in the hope of, as you said, and this is slow going to get all of the hurdles out of the way one after the other. What are the biggest stumbling blocks at this time? I mean, people can now travel if it's a business travel, but people are getting around that in different ways. If you have a double passport, as I do, you can travel, but the point is, how do people get down there if they want to go just to spend time there?
You're not supposed to spend time there, according to our government.
Just, if we want to do research,
you're not supposed
though.
To have fun, you know.
Yeah.
There are 12 categories of travel that the U.S. government allows to Cuba. That includes, of course, family visits. There's religious travel. There's educational travel. There's business travel. There are journalists. Everything but tourism. Now, the burden of proof is on you, the traveler, that you do fit into one of those categories. So it might be that when you return, a U.S. immigration agent will ask you, where have you been? You respond, Cuba, and then the immigration agent will ask, what did you do? And if you tell them, I had fun at the beach and was drinking mojitos, they'll drag you away.
Oh, really?
So you need to say, I was there for religious purposes. And then the agent may ask, what did you do? And then you will have to produce proof day by day of what you did.
A diary?
Something like a diary. This is what the travel operators have to do that bring U.S. citizens and residents to Cuba. They have to prove to the U.S. Treasury Department day by day what they have been doing with these groups, to make sure that they fit under these people-to-people categories and that no one had fun. I'm being facetious here, but this is how it works.
Well, Johannes, in terms of fun, the history of Cuba has been the Copacabana, you know, as Barry Manilow, the Copacabana. What is that? I mean, people spend, is there such a place at this time?
Well, Cuba is a good place to relax. I would argue, I mean, I'm not the beach kind of person, but Havana is a gorgeous and laid-back city. And if you compare that to other metropolises, you feel very safe there. There's very little street crime, practically no violence. It's gun control all over, so there's no firearms looming.
No NRA, huh?
So, I mean, you can sit at 11 p.m. on the square, the Cathedral Square in Old Havana, and all you hear is voices and the clanging of plates and forks and knives and music and no cars, no yelling, no excess. It's a very laid-back and culturally very, very interesting place.
Interesting from which perspective? It sounds like if you want a nightlife, it could be boring for people.
No, there is nightlife. Cuba is the land of music and dance. There's lots of theater. There is any kind of activity you can imagine. Havana is a wonderful place for that.
Does the Copacabana really still exist in the way we used to envision it?
You're probably talking about the Tropicana. The Copacabana is Brazil, Rio.
Oh, no, you're kidding me. I've had this misillusion my whole life.
The Tropicana Cabaret still exists. It is a tradition going back, I believe, to the 1930s or 40s. It's skimpy dancers.
Skimpy dancers, just what I fascinate about.
And there's so much more to Cuba and Havana, you know. I mean, they cherish their traditions, which is why the Tropicana still exists, but there's a lot of contemporary music. They do new stuff. There's new dance that has developed. Hip-hop, rap, you name it, techno. There's even hard rock and all kinds of Latin rhythms.
At one time, Cuba was also noted for something of the beginnings of a film industry, as I recall, and that is being pushed hard in Florida right now. So with the Copacabana and the fascination of the past and the mafia and all of those kinds of dark things that happened and all of the sordidness of the past, that's all been cleaned up, and of course the country is now full medical care and people don't worry about the prostitution and so on. Everything is becoming a lovely paradise, right?
Well, nothing is paradise in this reality, Augie. There is prostitution in Cuba, but there is no gambling. As I said, it's a safe environment. Very little crime is happening, very little street crime, certainly. Mm-hmm. So, yes, it is a nice place to be at. The film industry, that's a totally different issue. I don't know how this jives with the mafia, but Cuba built a thriving film production industry, may not be the right term because this is all state-run at this point. But you know, a lot of productions that have won awards that are Cuban, beginning with Strawberry and Chocolate and Yo Soy Cuba, and there are plenty of Cuban movies that are very well known and Cuban actors that are very well known. And if you talk about industry, what's happening now is that foreign film producers increasingly are using Cuba as a site for productions, as either as a backdrop or already just for production of films.
Well, the personal life of the Cuban and the, what they have gone through, what was and what is, and what they continue to go through, the things that they offer and bring hope for and don't want to lose is health care and all of that. What happens to a citizen from the United States if they go to Cuba and they become ill? What happens?
Well, you get treated.
And no bill?
It depends.
Oh, really?
If there's an emergency, no one asks about money or credit cards or whatever. Mm-hmm. That's a given. You're being treated. It might be you're being sent a bill afterwards, but what Cuba does is it requires of every foreign visitor to buy health insurance.
Oh.
So you...
What's the cost on
that? I think it's something like $15 per person for up to a month. I'm not exactly sure. Don't quote me on that, but it's a small amount every foreign traveler has to pay when they go to Cuba. Now, there's something in addition to that. There's medical tourism that's evolving. Cuba has expertise in specific areas, cancer treatment, they're very advanced, eye surgeries, very advanced, dental and orthodontry is developing very fast. Anything of addiction treatment, Cuba is really top with that, and they're consciously trying to attract foreigners to use these services.
So the dental industry may take off because in the United States you have to have special insurance for dental. There isn't part of Medicare, and it's doubtful that's going to be part of Medicaid. So people who can afford it, and of course Medicaid patients probably wouldn't be able to afford to go to Cuba unless the cost becomes realized in some low-cost way. We've talked about this before in the previous interview we had about the quality of medical care and the fact that there's some 100 or so students in the United States now that can become doctors, and I think, as I recall in our previous conversation. Is that changing, or is that improving, or where is that?
The medical care or U.S. students in Cuba?
Right. Well, either one.
I think the number of U.S. medical students in Cuba will increase. As you said, it's hovering around 100 right now, I believe. The Cuban government has provided full scholarships to these. Maybe this will be changing at one point, possibly. Mm-hmm. Young Americans will enroll in Cuban medical schools actually paying there because it's most likely a good deal in comparison to the United States.
Well, it's interesting. Countries are looking at the United States with their inferior approach to education, burdening students to come away with huge debt that they can barely struggle under. And Germany right now is offering free education to American students. It's about 4,000 to 6,000, depending, in Dusseldorf and in that vicinity. Where you can get a full education there and the ability to learn the language and not be a citizen of Germany. So these countries are looking at this country in its educationally deprived status and offering the things that we don't offer our own people.
We're talking to Johannes Warner of the Cuba Standard. If you'd like to ask him a question, feel free to call us at 941-745-1490.
Go ahead, Johannes. I've made that comment about the education being relatively free. Are you still there, Johannes?
I'm still there.
I thought we lost you.
Ask me a question, please.
since it's just come to my knowledge in the last few weeks that Germany and other countries in Europe are inviting American students who want free education and lodging and an offer of a job when they're done to come to those to Germany in particular. I think France is offering something as well. And here's Cuba with their offering. There seems to be a magnet possibility with the debt that the students have here in the United States to say, to hell with it, and let's go to these other places.
Well, there's a history to that. I mean, it doesn't take Cuba to offer another option. Medical students from the United States have been studying in places from Grenada, the tiny island in the Caribbean, to Puerto Rico because it's more affordable, to Mexico. They're all over the place because it's so unaffordable for students from regular backgrounds, middle class backgrounds, to study medicine in the United States. So Cuba is joining a number of options that already exist throughout the Caribbean and Latin America.
Mm-hmm. What future events do you expect to come to this area? Besides, I mean, the tour of the Manatee Port was really exciting for people, and evidently Ambassador Rodriguez had some impact. What do you expect to come down over the horizon?
For this particular region, I'm not sure if we will get any Cuban officials visiting in the near term or midterm. This was already a quite unusually high-profile visit, so I think if you want to interact with Cuban officials, you will have to go to Washington or, of course, to Havana. In terms of events, we will probably see an announcement by the Cuban government within, I would say, the next 1 year or two over which ferry service will be going to Havana.
Well, you also are a member and a secretary to the Southwest Coalition for Peace and Southwest Florida Coalition for Peace and Justice, and there's about to be a change in the leadership there. Will there be any discussion, you suppose, in the same direction to invite or to encourage or to include the Cuban and Hispanic people? As you mentioned, right now the I-4 corridor is being flooded with mainly Puerto Ricans who coming for some reason are leaving Puerto Rico to come to the United States, and their status is already that of a citizen, so they vote in the elections. I think the 40,000 voted in the 08 election and swung the election there to Obama, and 100,000 did the same thing in 2012. So how do you look at this change of populace? Unidos Now, some of these organizations locally, is there any kind of coordinated effort dealing with the Hispanics in this area? You have the Cubans, you have the Hispanics from Puerto Rico, you have the Mexicans who come in to work and so forth, and some who are coming from Central America and Costa Rica, maybe not Costa Rica, but some of the other countries, maybe some from South America. What's happening there?
Another very broad question. How should I start?
Take your pick.
Okay. Let's start with the Southwest Florida Coalition for Peace and Justice. This is an umbrella organization for, as the name says, peace and justice groups in this particular region. In terms of their working with the immigrant population, one of the member organizations has been the Unidos Now group. This is a very unusual and very effective group that tries to bring the immigrant population closer to the mainstream. Now, their name is half Spanish. but they're directing themselves at all immigrants in this area. And we sometimes tend to forget there are more immigrants. I'm one myself. So I'm very aware of the role immigrants play in changing the political landscape. The number keeps growing, although it has stagnated over the last few years, as you probably know. But what's happening is more and more of the immigrants that have come are moving closer to the mainstream, and that includes participating in elections and politics in the United States, their state and their county, their city. So yes, there is an increasing influence that immigrants play. Now, this is, I would argue, nothing new. It happens cyclically. I mean, remember what a big deal it was that when the first Catholic Irish background man was elected president of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen these cycles before. Whoa, suddenly Catholics are voting in the United States. They're going to change the country. It's terrible.
That was Juan Kennedy, right?
Juan F. Kennedy, yes, exactly. So, you know, the United States, I'm being facetious here, survived the Catholic, Irish, Italian onslaught and the German onslaught before that. And so now it's mostly Hispanic immigrants that we're watching and concerned about, but it's just another cycle in the life of this great country.
Well, Johannes, I really appreciate you coming in. We watch you on at least a monthly basis, if not more. If something new comes up, we want you to come back and do what you're doing. We're going to come to a break, and we have another guest to come on in the second half of the show. So I want to thank you again for all you do, hasta la vista?
Thanks for having me, Augie. Hasta la vista.
Okay. Thank you much, Johannes. Okay, I think we're going to... Are we going to a break right now?
Yeah, Sarasota is home to a true gift. The Posture Clinic of Sarasota with Dr. Mark D'Amato. 4450 South Tamiami Trail. Dr. D'Amato is a veterinary chiropractor treating horses, dogs, or your favorite four-legged friend. First and foremost, animal chiropractic care is not intended to replace traditional veterinary medicine. Complementary care is a type of care that works with your vet, and certainly not instead of them. To find out more information, call Dr. Mark D'Amato at 941-927-7009. That's 941-927-7009. Oh, and by the way, Dr. Mark treats two-legged patients, too.
With the animals, with the animals, and
and we are back at 1490 AM. We'll be having Dennis Malley call us back in just a moment. Hopefully Dennis is listening to us right now. And we'll put him on the air from the BradentonTimes.com. We were just speaking with Johannes Warner from the Cuba Standard about Cuban-American relations and the recent visit from Jose Ramon Cabanas Rodriguez, who will probably be our next Cuban ambassador. So Dennis, if you get a chance, please call us back. And this is 1490 AM, The Morning Edge. And this should be Dennis. Dennis, I'm going to take a gamble, put you right on live in the air. Welcome, Dennis.
Hey, guys. How are we doing today?
We're doing wonderful now that you called us back.
Yeah, we were discussing Port Manatee, and it's a real possible solution to whatever is deficient in this area. That may change the game a lot. But you have some issues that you want to talk about with respect to the school board,
big meeting on Tuesday. They moved ahead and accepted. Board member Mary Cantrell had proposed that they basically accelerate Mr. Mills' retirement. Of course, so Rick Mills, the superintendent who served for the last 2 years and brought the county out of this, multi-million dollar financial debacle they were in, first asked not to be reconsidered for an extension of his contract, which he said at the time, hey, you know, I'm not looking to leave, but I think this is going to be used as a distraction in a referendum. I think I've lost the support of the board. That became even more clear, and the board has been working against him, and I think they've got, you know, since the November election, they've got at least three votes moving away from his policies. They haven't supported any of his recommendations, and he said at this point, you know, I think my job is done here. Without the support of the board, I can't really implement my agenda, and I'm not really an effective leader. So he put in for his retirement in July, but at the meeting, Mr. Cantrell proposed that they basically get rid of him immediately, that they didn't want to have the term she used was a lame duck, that didn't have the support behind them. So they put together a plan and basically paid him the severance that is, you know, state statute, and he will be paid off to go away right away. And they had to name an interim superintendent. So that's where things got interesting. Now, if you go back 2 years ago to where the national search was conducted, so when Tim McGonigal resigned in disgrace and said, hey, you know, I've been covering up a multi-million-dollar budget shortfall. I've been telling the public and the board that it's a surplus, but it's not. I knew about this. And he waited until after the August elections of 2012, and they probably would have been pretty impactful on those school board elections. However, when he resigned in disgrace, they conducted a national search, and they put it out, and they got 29 candidates, I believe, in. I actually served on a citizen advisory group that was formed to go through the 29 candidates and just give feedback to the board and recommendations of the five best candidates. And the board also looked at them. And then they also had the Florida School Board Association look at them. And it was interesting because all three of them selected the same five candidates. It was pretty obvious that, you know, there were five that were really head and shoulder above the rest. In fact, one of them was Pam Stewart, who became the educational commissioner of the state of Florida. So it was a pretty, you know, the clear-cut five candidate, highest tier, I should say. Among them was Dr. Diana Green, who was at the time the number two, the assistant superintendent in Marion County, north of us. And she had a very impressive resume, not the least of which because Marion was rated above us. They were about six spots above us in the county rankings, despite the fact that they're a much poorer district. They have many more Title I students.
When you say how much higher?
They were six spots higher. So at the time we were ranked 47th in the state, but they were ranked 41st. But they were ranked 41st with less dollars per student from the county invested and with much more Title I students. So when you really looked at it and said, wow, they're doing more with considerably less to work with, and that was impressive, and she interviewed very impressively. The only knock on Dr. Green at the time was that she didn't have a tremendous amount of experience with budgeting, and with the mess that we're in financially, really all of these forces that were looking at these resumes were saying the same thing, that, you know, we need a budget guy. We need somebody who really understands the nuance of school district financing, which is some of the most complicated financing that there is, and can't really rely on anybody, because they had a team that was very suspect at the time, that eventually all transitioned, because they didn't know who knew all this stuff, who helped the cover up, you know, who's competent and who's not. So it was very difficult. So you didn't have a situation where you could have a typical superintendent come in and rely on your financial team. You know, a typical school district has four or five professionals who are very experienced in that realm who report to the superintendent. So ideally, your superintendent doesn't have to be a finance guy, a budget guy. But in this scenario, it was really felt that, no, you need somebody who needs to be able to look at those things and understand them on their own. And Mills had by far the strongest resume in terms of a finance and budget acumen, and that was probably that along with the fact that his strong leadership style, his military background, there was a lot of concern that because there was so much political divisiveness in the administration, that you needed a strong leader that was going to be able to not be slow-walked by other members that were still in the administration, and kind of led around by his nose. So now you have a situation where the district's in a very different place. You know, they're sitting on a surplus. They have corrected all of those budget shortfalls. And during the same time, they've improved their rankings, they've moved up 10 spots from 47 to 37. Now, when you think about that, that's kind of impressive to start with, but who actually gets better as you're cutting resources? So as you're making these really monumental cuts to try to balance this fund balance that the state requires that you have, that's usually an excuse to say, well, yeah, we didn't get better educationally, academically, but we didn't have the resources. They actually got better at the same time. And time and again, Mr. Mills gave credit on everything in the academic arena to Dr. Green and said, you know, she's the person there.
Relied on her, Dennis. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. You know, so now you're looking at it, you're saying, okay, you're in this situation. You have an abrupt, retirement, resignation, however you want to look at it, of your superintendent. 2 years ago, you conducted a big, expensive national search. You came away with two people. Remember, Dr. Green was the first person nominated, and she failed to get voted in on a 3-2 vote. So two people voted for her, three people voted against her. And on the very next ballot, somebody nominated Mills. Mills won by a 3-2 vote. So it was very, very close. There was one vote between them. And the very first person that Rick Mills hired when he got hired as superintendent was Dr. Diana Green. He met her for the first time during the interview process and said, I want her on her team. And she was in a situation where a superintendent had been replaced above her. There was some transition there. I don't know that she was really happy or feeling like she was on that team. And the decision was kind of made, hey, we have an opportunity here that we might be able to get the best number two we could. Our second choice for superintendent, really having our first two choices, join the team. So that was able to happen. Of course, she replaced, ultimately, in a reorganization, her position was basically replacing what had been filled out by Bob Gagnon, who was suspended for his felony arrest with the Manatee sexual abuse scandal, the failure to report aspect of it, and was originally charged with lying to police and investigators. So you have Dr. Green come in. You have the academic standings improved drastically. You have morale among principals improved drastically. You have really a person here who has been a finalist now in three or four other school districts in the 2 years since. There's people out there, looking for her, and we have her in house. And it's a very simple solution.
So you don't want her going away, is what it looks like.
No, absolutely. Why wouldn't we hire her immediately? So at the meeting on Tuesday night, when they were looking for an interim, they started talking about Dr. Green, but then it was immediately brought up that whoever served as the interim would be disqualified from applying for the replacement superintendent, because they felt it would, there would be too much, hard feelings or politics involved or an unfair advantage, whatever the case was. There's a lot of things mentioned, but Dr. Green said, I plan on staying in Manatee County and I plan on staying in this district, and absolutely, let me remind you, I was your number two. I was one vote away from being the superintendent. Yes, I would absolutely be interested in that position. So Don Hall, who's the deputy superintendent of operations, what you have now is a superintendent and then two deputy superintendents. One is oversees everything on the operational side, and that includes everything from maintenance to transportation, busing, cafeterias, all of those non-educational parts that go into administering a school district. It's a big job. Don Hall is at the top of that. And then you have the curriculum superintendent, which is everything on the education side, which is Dr. Green. Well, Don Hall said, I'm not looking to be the superintendent at this point in my life. I am, pleased to serve in whatever capacity you see fit. And I would like to say that, I think Dr. Green is an excellent candidate. He couldn't say enough good things about her. So, the real writing was on the wall there that you have a replacement. Now, to Charlie Kennedy, first-term school board member's credit, he said, I'm not even sure why we're not having this vote. Why aren't we voting for Dr. Green right now? We have her right here in our district. Why take the time? And, listen, when you look at it, why on earth would you want another major transition? Why would you want to bring in someone else? Why would you want...
Well, doesn't it occur to you that they picked Mills because he was had a military background? They wanted leadership. What is leadership anyway if you're not that effective in terms of the educational side? He depended on Green, it sounds like.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He'd be the first person to tell you that. So you have... Now you're in a very different place. You have a restored fund balance. You have a surplus. And everybody's been saying for a long time now, especially Mills' detractors, that we need to start making it about education again. It can't just be about finance and the budget. And it's got to be about the kids. Well, of course, there is no about the kids if you have no money to give them the resources to educate them. But if that's the case, well, here's your person. And the other comment that was made was, Mr. Mills was an outsider. He failed because he didn't understand Manatee County. They've evoked several times the ghost of Dan Nolan and Gene Witt, former superintendents who served at very different times, but that came up through that administration, and they're saying, we need one of us. Well, you've got someone from within. You've got someone that's been here for 2 years succeeding, building relationships with principals in the district, with teachers in the district, with families and parents in the district. You have an insider, but it's very obvious with that good old boy network that Dr. Diana Greene is not what they're talking about. And let's be frank with it, the idea that a lot of those powers that be would be interested in an African-American female superintendent is, as I said in my column yesterday, to put it lightly, improbable.
Ooh. And Superintendent Greene is...
She is African-American. And you cannot... the elephant in the room here is there has long been a glass ceiling for African-American employees in the Manatee County School District. And they, so there is... And listen, when in early 2013, when they were making this decision... There were Barbara Harvey, who was an African-American, was a teacher and then an administrator in the school district, and then was actually fired as an administrator and came back and ran for the board, and then served on the board a very long time, and just recently retired in 2012. She pushed Dr. Greene very hard. It was very clear that she was going to vote for her. She tried to rally support in the community. There were a lot of people that came in and said, we should hire her because she's African-American, because we've never had an African-American superintendent, because the disadvantaged students in a lot of these schools should be able to look and see somebody that looks like them in this position. That argument was made a lot at that school board meeting. And I opined at the time in the colloquy that, listen, as qualified as a candidate as I believe she is, and I'll disclose that when I served in that committee, I ranked her as number two. As qualified as I believe she is, I don't think race is ever a reason to hire someone. But I think it goes without saying that it's also a reason not to hire them.
Exactly.
And I think that's where I am now. I felt at the time that, and I think I said it at the time, that Dr. Greene would have been the candidate you would have wanted to hire if you could, if you were in a better position than the district was at that time. Now you are, exactly. So my point was she was number two because, unfortunately, we've been put in a position where our needs and our requirements aren't what they should typically be. As I said earlier, you shouldn't typically say the strongest thing your superintendent should be able to do is a budget and budget building and fund balances. They should have qualified people on their team to do that. We were in a very different place. We didn't have the people on the team, and we didn't have the money in the bank. So we needed a very specific skill set, and like I said, we needed a strong leader because there was a lot of politics and shenanigans going on, and there needed to be somebody to come in and cut that right out like a cancer.
Well, Mills was the right guy.
And it's a shame that it happened that fast, but as a lot of people said, he has got the job he was assigned to do done. I don't think it was fair what the community a very small circle in the community did to him. And the gratitude they showed for that, I think it's an embarrassment.
Dennis, the larger issue here, and people are saying it, and you're saying it, they're there to serve the kids. And now that the economics are somewhat in order, there seems to be an effort, or needs to be the effort, to better do that job.
Absolutely.
And so when you talk about ranking, you move from 47 to 37, but you're in a state that's ranked like 46th in the nation. So what part of the bottom of the barrel are you going to talk about here?
Absolutely. There is no denying the fact that Manatee County has a long way to go, even when you compare to Sarasota County. I've said that before. When you're a bottom third school in a bottom of the barrel state, there's a long way to go to climb. I will tell you that having a student in Manatee County Schools, where I volunteer regularly, where I know a lot of principals, a lot of teachers, having a child in there, we have a lot of talent in this district. We have a lot of great teachers. I have been, I will be honest, when I came down here and had a child, I was skeptical about all you hear about Southern schools and Florida and the state of education. There are some great schools in our district, and there are some great administrators, some great principals, some great teachers. We are a challenged district in many ways. We have a lot of challenge schools. You know, when I went out to, I do the Every Child's Reader program with Kiwanis, and, you know, last year was instrumental because I went to two schools. One of them was probably the second, I believe, highest median income in the elementary school in the district, and the other was the lowest. Mm-hmm. And so I got to really see the stark difference in VPK, so voluntary pre-kindergarten, four-year-old students. And when you sat in those rooms and saw at the wealthy one, every single student at 4 years old knew how to read, mm-hmm. and was read to every night, you know, is what they reported to me. Every single student at the other didn't know how to read a word and was never read to. It was a very, very rare thing. They were talking about maybe one instance where somebody read them a book one time. So when you see the differences in what's happening outside the school and the challenge that presents, because you know, Augie, in education, you know as well as anyone, how do you ever catch those kids up? That kid at four that can't read a word and that other kid...
Well, one of the ways that needs to happen, and I had some experience, I taught 15 years in college and community college and so forth, and a year in high school, and I had very good success, and but basically I never assumed, as many teachers do, that you should be at this point or you shouldn't be in this class, and that's mm-hmm. that. And by the way, you're in the wrong class because you're tracked to be over here. And we have all these archaic ideas about what education really is, and it's the ability of someone to carry forward the job to the expertise that they bring to the job or don't, as the case may be. And the fact of the matter is, liberal arts education, which is often what students come out of to go to college or to advanced learning, whatever, is the source of most of your high-end executives in this country. The biggest number are like 68% coming from that background. So you have the opportunity if you find a way to do it. Now, what I'm coming to, you just cited how you helped and so forth, and your son has been in the studio, and he's really a bright kid, and he's full of life, and he's full of advantage and opportunity. He knows it. How many kids are going to be in his boat? That's the problem. And how can you better make that happen? I happen to think that there needs to be a real serious system. I talked to board members down in Sarasota who claim to be having a great system. They have the same problem, and they claim more success than Manatee. I'm not sure there's really any difference in this general area. It just depends on school-by-school circumstance.
Correct.
And that, to me, is the problem. If there's going to be a plan, there needs to be a practical plan. I mean, in Japan, the kids fix their own lunch in their own classroom. They don't leave the classroom. And they work in teams of five with a leader in each of the groups of five and a teacher acting as a supervisor to see how it's going within the classroom. Homework is not such a factor. Homework is an excuse not to do the work in the classroom by some teachers, in my opinion. So the point is a better approach overall, and I think an interview with Dr. Green is in order on that score to see how she would do a generalized change if the principals have a lot of power within Sarasota County. I don't know what kind of power they have in Manatee, but the coordination between the board and the principals, I don't know that the public understands what that amounts to.
Yeah, you know, and it's changing a lot right now because of the curriculum, challenges that are being placed on the schools. But when you look at it, and my point is that's really the biggest thing with Manatee County is that we're a little more challenged in Sarasota County, and we're less funded. There's a bigger budget with less students in Sarasota County because they have that extra mill. Now, that extra half mill, or one mill, excuse me. The Manatee District has brought that up and kind of used that as an excuse. Well, the difference between Sarasota and Manatee is they invest in education. But the difference also is that they haven't given their taxpayers a reason to be skeptical of investment. And this is, again, Augie, this is one of those decisions. Decisions have consequences. And when you say, I'm going to come back in 2016, and this is what the district has said, and the board has said, that we're going to be forced to ask you to give us a full extra voluntary mill on your property taxes, a half-cent sales tax to help fund us, and then to also allow us to bond $150 million in additional debt when we're looking at it, when you're on the hook for about a $500 million already. If you're going to come back and do that, you can't do it after doing these shenanigans and saying, well, we're going to absolve anybody that was got in trouble, and we're going to pay their legal fees as long as they knew the right people and as long as they were on the right side, when things were going down. And when you look at it now, if they don't put Dr. Green in, I think it's a very clear reason why not, is, as a lot of people are skeptical of, they're looking to put another stooge in. They're looking to put a lackey in who's going to go along to get along, make sure the vendors get the right contracts when these new schools are built, make sure these bids get steered as we saw in this last bond.
I know the solution, Dennis. Make sure you bring in somebody who says, I'll make sure that Manatee High School stays number one in the nation in high school football.
There you go. There you go. And that's the kind of, you know, and make sure that, certain well-connected people in local education can make a phone call and get so-and-so a good job, or get so-and-so transferred as an assistant principal somewhere, or get so-and-so out of trouble when they get into it. That's what we've seen in Manatee County for too long, Augie. The school district and the bloated administration was a soft place to land for well-connected people. And you had too many people making $80,000, $90,000, $100,000 a year even, who could never have commanded that kind of money in the private job market with their thin resumes. But it was a trough that too many people were feeding off of it. And when that trough dried up, somebody came in. And listen, this is history repeating itself. I think it was 1998. There was a guy named Gene Denisar who came in. He was a superintendent. An outsider was brought in when they were having problems. And he made some big changes, and it didn't go over very well. And guess how long he was here for?
Not long.
2 years, buddy. Just to say, it's almost deja vu here. 2 years, and all of a sudden it was, you know, we need one of our own again. We need somebody who understands Manatee County.
What you might want to think about doing, and you're obviously a leader, and your son admires you no end. But I think you and your son and other parents and so forth should get together and form your own plan and what you think it needs to happen, what the future should involve for this area, and what the board should be looking at when it's replaced by future members, and what constitutes a real interest in success, or what success really
well,
means.
Step one of my plan was in yesterday's column at www.thebradentontimes.com.
Oh, I didn't read that one.
And that's step one to the plan, so check that out. But, you know, listen, they've got a lot to prove to this community. They've got a lot of trust to earn, and this board has done nothing since November but shenanigans. So if they're going to ask for that kind of blank check, they've got a long way to go. And step one would be to make the very obvious choice. But there's a problem when the thing that's, when the best choice and the most obvious choice seems like the least likely.
Ah, what a shame. Well, Dennis, thank you so much. This is always great with you. We had you on Monday, and we're hoping to have you any other time but Friday afternoons, after the second half of the show, for sure.
So, you got it, partner. Keep up the great work, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dennis.